You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Doctors continue to be limited in the fight against cancer. Although chemotherapy and radiation are effective in some cases, they come with a large number of unpleasant side effects. But there's been a paradigm shift in the treatment of cancer recently through very targeted means. In her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, Jessica Wapner traces the medical discoveries that led to the development of the drug Gleevec, the first ever genetic level treatment for a deadly cancer. It's published by The Experiment, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Wapner to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
How many people are afflicted each year with this illness, chronic myeloid leukemia, or CML?
In the U.S., it's about 5,000 people per year. Worldwide, it's about 1 or 2 per 100,000.
So it's a rare disease.
That's right. To put it in perspective, breast cancer is diagnosed in about 230,000 people in the U.S. each year.
Before the arrival of Gleevec, what percentage of those cases were fatal within a few years?
Every case is pretty much fatal. When you're diagnosed with CML, you are given about 4 to 6 years to live.
What does it do to your body?
It can. CML is a disease that causes a proliferation of white blood cells that don't mature properly and end up taking up all of the space in our bone marrow and don't allow healthy cells to grow, will lead to an enlarged spleen. Left untreated, a person would bleed out and die in a few
years. Is that particularly painful?
Sure, I would imagine so.
You open your book with the story of Gary Eichner, who was diagnosed with CML in 2012. What would the prognosis have been had that happened 40 years ago? Well, you said death within a few years.
That's right. A person could undergo a bone marrow transplantation if they're a candidate for such a treatment, but only about half of the patients who go through that survive it. It's an incredibly harsh process.
So there are lots of different leukemias, aren't there?
There are many types of leukemia. This chronic myeloid leukemia, the word chronic refers to the fact that it progresses slowly.
And it's caused by what's called the Philadelphia chromosome. Why Philadelphia?
It's called the Philadelphia chromosome because of the city in which it was discovered back in 1959. Two scientists, Peter Noel and David Hungerford, researching at the University of Pennsylvania and Fox Chase Cancer Center, spotted this abnormally small chromosome in samples of blood cells from patients with chronic myeloid leukemia. It was amazing that he even noticed it. It was this tiny little speck through a microscope.
And what were they looking for?
They were just looking.
They stumbled upon this?
They did just stumble upon it. David Hungerford was this man who was this sort of classic scientist. He just loved to observe. He loved to stand at the microscope, look through it, and take pictures of what he saw. He wasn't after fame and glory. He was after just observing nature, observing life, and he spotted this chromosome. Peter Noel had happened to stumble across a method to expand cells in a way that was bigger than people had been able to do before. So they were able to look at chromosomes in their most expanded form at the time.
Well, how much did we know about genetics at that time?
Very little, of course. I mean, Watson and Crick had only talked about the DNA helix in 1953. Down syndrome was known to be caused by a genetic mutation, but nobody had an idea that cancer was caused by genetic.
And Peter Noel developed a system that would halt cell division. How did that work?
There was a bean extract that he used that was able to stop the cell in the middle of dividing. And he had also, because he was being lazy, he had washed his cell samples, washed the slides with tap water instead of another kind of water, and that ended up kind of ballooning the cell. So he had it frozen with that bean extract, and then it was expanded to its utmost, and then they could see the chromosomes. It was still very rudimentary. It was a microscope with a camera attached to it.
So there's just a bean extract? Accidentally used?
That's right. It was the tap water that expanded cells bigger than normal. And those two things combined together, Peter Noel said, you know, I don't know anything about genetics, but I bet there's somebody who does. And so he kind of kept this method, kept these cells, and met David Hungerford, who was one of a handful of people in Philadelphia studying genetics.
Well, not all cancers are created by faulty genes or gene mutations. Mm-hmm. But do we know how many are?
Well, that's the cutting edge of research right now. That's one of the cutting edges of research, is finding the genetic underpinnings of cancer, finding the driver mutations.
In some cases, we may have an inclination towards something, but it will be triggered by something else.
That's right. It could be a combination between the environment and genetics. And sometimes it's an inherited mutation. Sometimes it's a spontaneous mutation, as in this disease.
You write that the discovery of the Philadelphia chromosome and the picture taken of it, quote, would become the lasting portrayal of a moment when everything changed for cancer and medicine as a whole. It was the as yet unrecognized starting point for the modern era of targeting cancer at its root cause.
That's right.
Right away, 40 years ago, or did it take a while for people to figure out what they were seeing?
No, that's what's so incredible about this story, is how long it took. Nobody was thinking, well, let's make a drug to treat this. Let's figure out what this mutation is about and make a drug. In 1959, people didn't even know that our healthy genes can mutate, and in that mutated state trigger cancer. That took decades of research.
Does the Philadelphia chromosome always result in a person developing CML?
Well, we wouldn't know if there were people walking around with this mutation who didn't get cancer, but in about 95% or more of people who have CML, they have the Philadelphia chromosome.
And since they found the Philadelphia chromosome when looking at people with CML, they understood that link.
It took many years to unravel the link, and I chart that in the book. The science, the many different threads of science that led from spotting this mutation in 1959 to, by the mid-1980s, the picture becoming clear of what exactly happened, how this mutant gene encodes a mutant protein, and how that mutant protein triggers the unchecked production.
And it sounds like a really complicated process. The Philadelphia chromosome occurs when chromosome 22 swaps some genetic material with chromosome 9.
That's right. It's right. It's two chromosomes. It's in a way, it's complicated. In a way, it's so minuscule, though. It's two tiny bits of two chromosomes swapping places. And that small, unpredictable, unpreventable change is enough to cause this cancer.
Now, do those kinds of swaps happen a lot in our bodies?
It's difficult to say. Apparently, genetic mutations happen a lot. Sometimes they come and go. Sometimes they don't do anything.
They usually just die off.
That's right. They can arise. They can disappear. They don't do anything. Sometimes, in about 5,000 people in the U.S. per year, this mutation occurs that causes cancer.
My guest is Jessica Wapner. Her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene, and The Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. A large part of the story involves an enzyme called kinase. What do kinases do?
A kinase is a type of protein, as you said, an enzyme that starts processes. So it's in the name kinase, kinetic. It puts things into motion. The kinase at the heart of this story is one that sets in motion the production of white blood cells. In its mutated state in this disease, it never stops giving that signal. Normally, we've got it a green light and a red light with production of white blood cells. In the mutant state, it's always a green light, which is why a body ends up being filled with white blood cells.
And do we know now how Gleevec blocks runaway kinase?
Yes. This drug, Gleevec, blocks it's called the binding site. It's complicated science that I elaborate on in the book, of course, that blocks the binding site where the kinase gives that signal. It stops the protein from giving that signal to produce these white blood cells.
Well, normally white blood cells are out there to protect us. They will go after all of the invading bodies. And yeah, I mean, they try mm-hmm. to keep us healthy. That's what they're there for. Mm-hmm. So in this case, what are they doing? They're out of control and they're eating up everything?
Well, they don't mature. So they don't really do much of anything. And the blood cells, the white blood cells in our bodies that do mature, just don't have enough space to grow. And there's not enough room for white blood cells. So it's kind of just a useless situation. It's extra baggage.
How effective is Gleevec in fighting CML? Do people respond pretty quickly?
Yes. this drug was, at the time, the most successful cancer drug ever made. People who take this drug, and it's a pill that they swallow once a day, can live a normal, healthy life. It is, there are now second and third generation Gleevec. There are small populations of patients who might not respond or stop responding, and there's other ones that might work a little better that have been approved in the years since.
But this is not a cure. This is something you have to keep on taking.
That's right. You have to keep taking the drug once a day to keep the disease at bay.
Is this analogous to HIV drugs?
It is.
Well, that's also immune system.
It's not an immune system drug. It's targeting the protein in a cell. So it's not treating our immune system in the same way, but in the sense of you have to take your medication. It is.
It's just been described as a rational drug. What does that mean?
Rational drug design was, so as I said, this picture became clear in the 1980s. And that was when people started thinking, can we make a drug to block this cancer? So different from the way cancer drugs had been developed until then, which was, let's try this, let's try that. Well, nitrogen mustard worked in warfare. Maybe it can treat cancer cells. We know the mechanism. Let's design a compound to block that mechanism. It was rational. It was thought out first. We now call that targeted therapy is the more common catchphrase.
And this is the alternative to the usual treatments for cancer?
That's
which
right.
Are chemo and radiation. Mm-hmm. Were chemo and radiation at all effective in CML?
The major drug for treating CML before Gleevec was an immune system drug called interferon.
That has the most terrible effect on people's bodies.
It's like walking around with the flu. I mean, our bodies produce interferon naturally when we're infected with the flu virus. So what symptoms we have are that's our body making interferon. So imagine, I mean, people describe sleeping for 22 hours a day for a year and just walking around in a haze.
Does Gleevec have side effects?
Very minimal side effects. It has, in the beginning, patients experience bone pain because their bone marrow has been filled with white blood cells. And as that ends, the bones are painful. But mostly, no. Mostly, it's not anything like what we're used to hearing about.
Now, it's been pointed out that over 200,000 breast cancer diagnoses will be made this year. The number of people with CML, you say, is about 5,000. Mm-hmm. Haven't some argued that researchers may be applying the wrong priorities?
Well, one of the reasons why this drug was made in the first place was to prove the principle behind what's called kinase inhibition, this kind of drug development, blocking a kinase. So although CML is a rare disease, and that was a whole problem to get the drug company to try out the drug on patients because it's a rare disease.
And so they're not going to make very much money, although
exactly.
We'll get into how much money they actually make later.
Yeah. And they did make this drug in part because they had to test out the principle. So always when we're researching cancer drugs, I mean, there's always a question of which diseases are getting left out. One of the reasons was to prove that kinase inhibition could work, which this did.
But it's not working in treating other kinds of cancers?
Well, there's about 15 of these kinds of drugs approved now and about 100 more in the pipeline. And it's a $10 to $15 billion a year market. So they are doing something. Whether it's an extra month of life, an extra 6 months of life, it depends on the disease. There's one for kidney cancer, liver cancer. There's a subset of lung cancer patients. So they are trickling into the marketplace.
And you describe this as a game changer.
Absolutely, because it showed that it is possible to, one, create a drug that blocks cancer at its root cause, and two, create a drug to treat an orphan rare disease and still earn money off of that.
Well, pretty much all cancers come from mutations, don't they? Cell mutations. So wouldn't they, all the research, start the same way that this research started?
Pretty much every pharmaceutical company these days has a kinase inhibitor program, and everybody is looking for the genetic underpinnings of cancer. It's a major thrust, and this story is the origin for how we got to our current moment in cancer research.
My guest is Jessica Wepner, who's a science writer whose work has appeared in publications that include Scientific American, Slate, The New York Times, The Atlantic.com, New York Magazine, Science, Nature, Medicine, The Ecologist, The Scientist, Psychology Today. Her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, is published by The Experiment. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with science writer Jessica Wapner, whose book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, is published by The Experiment. I don't know this book company.
The Experiment is a relatively new publishing company. They publish all different kinds of books. It's not necessarily a science house, although the name sounds like it is. Yeah, they're wonderful, wonderful people there.
At the center of your book is the oncologist and researcher Dr. Brian Drucker. How did he come to work on CML?
Brian Drucker was a cancer doctor and laboratory researcher at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And he had been following this unfolding story of the connection between the Philadelphia chromosome and CML. And he was one of a handful of people at the time who was saying, we can make a drug to target this. I mean, he has an amazing personal story of how he came to want to be in a position where he was going to be the one finding that drug. And he was treating cancer patients in a community hospital in Neshoba. And, of course, they all die. And he, at some point, just said to himself he wanted to fulfill. It was around the same time he was getting this picture of creating a rationally designed drug and realizing that what he wanted to do was make that drug. He wanted to be part of it. He wanted to make good on the promise he had made to the families of patients who had died, that he was going to go into the laboratory and not come out until he had something better.
So he's starting at the bottom of the ladder, even though. Understanding and identifying the genes which give patients certain cancers is important, but do scientists also need to look at the rest of their genetic profiles? I would assume that, as I said earlier, there's a genetic predisposition toward creating the Philadelphia gene.
Yeah, why the gene arises, why this mutation happens, the best we know right now is it's a spontaneous change. There's no rhyme or reason to it. There are likely environmental triggers. We know that there are environmental triggers to different mutations that can happen. This one, I don't know that we have any information like that.
Don't genes also determine how fast we might metabolize certain drugs? Wouldn't that be important in treatment?
Yes, there's all kinds of ways that genetic changes can influence how we respond to something, what happens in our bodies. The reason why this drug is such a success story in part is because of the direct connection. I talked about how it proved the principle, and that's because it's this one-to-one relationship. This mutation causes this disease.
As the price of genetic sequencing is coming down dramatically, do you expect more personalized medicine and rational drugs to become part of our doctor's office experiences?
Most likely, yeah. I mean, I think this is definitely something that is on all of our minds. The way Brian Drucker talked about it with me is that he sees tumor sequencing to be the next wave. That is getting the genetic profile of a tumor and then shaping the treatment around that.
Are there privacy concerns in this area, as there seem to be every time we talk about this subject?
Yeah, there's always going to be concerns about everything. But if there are drugs to treat cancer at those root causes, we're going to find a way to get those treatments out.
Dr. Drucker's early research into kinase inhibitors looked promising, but it took half a decade for his work to move into human trials. Why did it take so long?
Well, there were a couple of different reasons for the delay. He had done studies on cells in his laboratory. By then, he was in Portland. And scientists at Ciba Geigy at the time in Switzerland had sent him several compounds, several candidates that they'd been working on. He tried them out, and he knew right away one of them was killing CML cells. And not just a little bit, it was a complete annihilation. Any drug company seeing that would go rush to get that drug into animal studies, into clinical trials. The delay was twofold. One, because this was a risky new thing. I mean, the shadow of thalidomide still hangs over the pharmaceutical industry. Nobody wants to have that next disaster. If this drug was going to hit more than one kinase, as one of the investigators put it to me, that's going to be one sick patient. But there was other concerns as well, which was the economic concern.
And that's what I want to talk about now. Dr. Robert A. Weinberg wrote the foreword to your book, and he says the development of Gleevec might never have occurred because those keeping the books said that the cost of drug development would never be compensated by sales. How close do you think we came to not having this drug on the market?
Very close, according to many of the people that I spoke with, both inside the industry and outside the industry. There was concerns that because this disease occurred in just 5,000 people per year, the market for the drug, which is how we talk about a patient population when it's an industry thing, the market was too small to guarantee that the company would recoup on its investment.
Well, Novartis, the company that produces the drug, earns around $4.7 billion each year from those 5,000 patients.
Yes. So, which it's a blockbuster.
That's a lot of money per person. Who's paying for it?
Well, it's a combination, of course, between our out-of-pocket expense and insurance coverage.
And where does the money go? Are they doing more research into it, or is this just simply something that the shareholders of Novartis are happy about?
Right. Well, it's probably all of the above. Most likely a combination. We'll never know. But it's a combination. A company is beholden to their stockholders, so they have to earn as much money as possible. They also are investing it, putting part of that back into research and development. I wish they would give some back to the taxpayers in honor of all the research that was funded in the basic science years.
In 2001, the price of Gleevec for a patient was around $30,000 a year in the United States. But since then, the price has tripled. Why would it go up so much now that they know how to produce it?
Well, one explanation, and I'm sure there's many, one explanation is that drugs cost what the market will bear. It's a free market economy. This is for-profit healthcare. And if the drug is working, then patients are going to pay whatever they're asked to pay to get the drug.
Well, Dr. Drucker, who was instrumental in developing Gleevec, has criticized the price. He told the New York Times last month, if you're making $3 billion a year on Gleevec, couldn't you get by with $2 billion? Hmm. When do you cross the line from essential profits to profiteering?
Yes, it's such a huge issue with this drug and all cancer drugs. Right now, Gleevec, and as I said, the second and third generation, in the U.S., they cost about $100,000 per year.
Now, was the research that led to the development of the drug particularly expensive? Are they recouping all of that investment?
It is expensive to make, but most likely they recouped on that investment within the first couple of years.
And you suggested also that a lot of the money comes from the government.
Well, the basic research, as I said, this story begins in 1959. And actually, some of the science goes back to 1910, to this chicken virus that was discovered in Rockefeller Institute on the Upper East Side. Most of the research between then and up till the 1980s, up until the first kinase program at Ciba-Geigy, was largely funded by federal grants.
And also work in universities, you're suggesting.
Yes, yes, it was. I mean, so Howard Hughes Medical Institute, different institutions, but a lot of it is research grants through the NIH.
My guest is Jessica Wapner. Her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene, and The Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, is published by The Experiment. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What did a chicken virus have to do with the story?
It's a wonderful story. This farmer came in to this man, Peyton Rouse, in 1910, carrying her Plymouth barred rock hen, this hen that had a tumor sticking out of its belly. And she wanted Peyton Rouse to surgically remove the tumor. I mean, could you imagine this happening today? It just would not happen. And he agreed. The hen died from remnants of the cancer spreading through its body. But now he had this tumor. And, you know, why waste a good tumor, I suppose? So he ground it up and put it through a filter. He managed to extract a little bit of a virus. I mean, he didn't know it was a virus, but what he extracted, he injected into another chicken, and that chicken got the same cancer. So he said, it's transmissible. It has to be a virus. What was important about that research was not that Peyton Rouse had found a chicken virus that caused cancer, although that is fascinating, but that discovery, that research eventually, and I mean eventually over decades, led to the understanding of the genetic roots of cancer, that the genetic roots of cancer are in our own bodies. That concept was totally foreign, very strange. I mean, why would our healthy DNA undergo a mutation and give itself cancer, give our bodies cancer?
So it really wasn't a virus. It was really just transmitting a chromosome or a gene that was going to create a cancer in the next chicken.
That's right. The story was that the virus had picked up a gene from the chicken previously, and as it got integrated into the viral genome, that gene mutated, and that was that mutated gene that was causing the cancer.
Well, we recently passed the 10-year anniversary of the full mapping of the human genome. Did that project produce the kinds of breakthroughs that we were promised a decade ago, especially in areas like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has led to some unexpected routes toward discoveries. There's the Cancer Genome Atlas, which is an open atlas of cancer genetic research. There's ENCODE, which is trying to understand how genes work, what they are. I mean, ENCODE has recently, it was a few months back, reported that most of what our genes encode is still unknown, that the amount of genes that encode proteins is much fewer than we thought. So I think it's opened up a lot of mysteries about genetics, but also a lot of promising leads.
Can we use viruses to insert genes into cells?
Well, gene therapy, all of this research is still ongoing. How all of this happens, that viruses came into this story as a sort of a vehicle of research. It enabled people to study cancer, to watch it happen in a cell, in a petri dish. They could see it happen by having these viruses.
Well, viruses attach themselves to our genetic material, don't they?
Mm-hmm. It can get into a cell and proliferate and keep that gene, drop it off, pick it up.
The U.S. patent for Gleevec was set to expire later this month, wasn't it?
Right now it's set to expire in 2015.
In January?
Yeah, in January or July. It's changed a few times.
How much? So that's probably because Novartis sent lobbyists to Washington and said, let's extend this a bit. We're making so much money. We don't want to give it up.
Right. I mean, that goes into the whole topic of evergreening and how drug companies extend patent life even when the drug hasn't necessarily changed at all.
So they don't have to change the drug? Or do they make a little, they just change a little bit and say, we have a really new drug here?
Sometimes that can happen where the chemical structure is changed just a little bit. I've heard all kinds of things. I've heard about a drug company saying that because the chemical changes once we swallow the pill, that chemical inside our bodies could be patented, or the dosage gets changed, or a generic manufacturer gets a sum of money to delay production.
And Novartis became involved in a long patent fight in India where a generic Gleevec was being made.
That's right.
So generics have been made of Gleevec, or are they prevented because of that patent fight?
Well, in India, of course, the generic industry is very different from here, and the laws are different, and they would not recognize Gleevec as a patentable drug because they don't recognize drug patents from before 1995. And the formula that Novartis was trying to patent in 95, the Indian government said, was not different enough from the one in 93 to warrant its own patent. So they rejected that request.
Well, in India, 40% of the population earns less than $1.25 a day. I don't think they could afford Gleevec.
No, and the company talked a lot about how it was giving Gleevec for free to about 16,000 patients per year. But then there were still hundreds of thousands who were taking the drug, the generic form of the drug. So it wasn't, whatever they were doing, it wasn't enough.
Now, in India, does the generic, is it only used in India, or is that generic form then also sold in other parts of the world in competition with Novartis?
I mean, most likely sold in other parts of the world. The generic market in India is a $10 billion a year market, and largely that's exports.
Now, we've made the point that CML is very specific. So can we hope to see some kind of a Gleevec for other cancers?
That's the vision, a Gleevec for every cancer. It's one of the chapter titles in my book because it's such a strong vision held by Brian Druker and so many other people. I mean, we've all been touched by cancer. We all know someone who's suffered from cancer. We've watched how horrible it is. If there could be a pill for every cancer, I mean, that's the dream. Whether or not that will happen in the next 50 years is the question. This book is kind of the origin story for how we got to that dream, how we got to that vision. And we're at the start of a new era where a Gleevec for every cancer is the vision, is the guiding light of research.
Jessica Wapner's book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level, is published by The Experiment. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.